Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy Sneed. She's still alive, apparently, over at the AFL-CIO NPR Times.
You didn't do your sneeding. Psst.
Psst. Sneedling.
I'm not feeling that.
Here's that representatives from Chicago and New York have been canoodling.
Did you? Seriously, that is her word right there.
With DNC brass, it's looking more and more like the DNC in 2024 will come to Chicago, according to a Sneed source. Between Chicago, New York, yeah. Oh boy, it's such a tough choice. Do you want to be
murdered or mugged?
Yeah? You want to be dodging a guy with an axe at the McDonald's at one of the public transit operations, or do you want to be diving for your lives at one of the patios in the West Loop?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
What can we do to get the DNC to Chicago? I guess keep doing what we're doing. It seems to be working. We're in the lead. Of course, it's a perfect representation of Democrat socialist policies. This is ground zero for perhaps even more so than New York City or the West Coast. It's really something we've accomplished here, isn't it? Yeah. Although Atlanta and Houston have also been vying, as Dem convention sites. The worry is that neither one of those cities have enough crime. So it just doesn't
Houston
rise to the level.
Houston would probably be their safest spot. Atlanta, there's parts that are dicey.
Maybe when they get serious and eliminate cash bail and release violent predators.
Oh. Right.
Maybe then they'll get the attention of the DNC brass, Mr. Harrison and the folks there in D.C. Yeah, yeah. The big problem overshadowing Chicago and New York, according to Sneed, is public safety. Is that right? Crime may be increasing in New York, but Chicago's crime has been the biggest national impact news-wise. It's the proverbial fly in the ointment, the source said. She has the best sources.
I think she's great sources. I think she's canoodling with her sources is what I think is happening. I honestly thought that she retired. I didn't know that she was still in the game.
No. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Also from the Sneed filing. Yeah. Her sources tell her that R. Kelly is a bit of a sexual predator.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, that's why he's going away. Yes.
So, I think we're going to get the 2024 at DNC. Don't you? I mean, it's...
Except for that fly in the ointment, you know, the people being murdered and maimed.
They like traffic jams. Oh, if they love, you know, street race, drag racing, and drifting, this is the place to be. I mean, maybe... Actually, that could be one of the safest weeks of our life, if you know, living here in Chicago, because they'll have the salt trucks at every intersection. They'll have, you know, Illinois State Police. They'll be working together, you know, with our shared values to keep the streets safe. But, you know,
the perimeter of the DNC is going to look like something out of a sci-fi movie to try to keep
to try
to prevent from any serious incident happening.
They'll put up fencing around
every convention center at every convention in every city. I'm talking about like District 6 type stuff. I'm talking about like flying. I'm talking about like drones that are weaponized. I'm talking about, I don't know, whatever they have dreamed up in Silicon Valley to provide for physical security. I don't know what they're going to do, but I know it's going to look like the green zone in Kabul. I know that. Greg and Rogers Park are on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi, good morning. You know, I hate bringing up the negative on all this. But,
oh, no, because there's nothing but positives. Yeah.
Yeah. No, but my point is that Sean Thompson told me that once if Jelly Belly is reelected, we'll go back to junk bond status as a state, and then Chicago's got financial issues. How are we going to be able to afford it, and how can we represent the DNC being a city that's in bankruptcy and broke because all the federal funds will be gone from COVID?
Yeah.
Well, a broke,
crime-ridden, dystopian city. That's a feature for the DNC, not a bug.
And I'm sure we're going to have the disaster proclamation still in place by then in 2024, because Pritzker won't let that go. So we'll be broke, everything you can imagine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Bipartisan money will always be a key, because this is a big deal for the city. But Pritzker has money he's willing to use, and it looks like Chicago, located in a solid blue state, which hosted a hugely successful Dem National Convention in 96 at the United Center, has the edge, according to sources. Yeah. Uh-huh.
We'd have it at the United Center, why not? Okay. Yeah, back there. Huh.
What can we do to sweeten the pot? We got Pritzker's money. We got lawlessness.
I'm sorry, Pritzker.
We're bankrupt. We've got terrible schools.
Carjackings are out of control.
Well, yeah, just the general lawlessness. What? There's something we're missing. Something we got the Chicago Fire. They can go see a Chicago Fire game at Soldier Field since the Bears no longer play there, or they won't by 2024. You know, God willing. Oh, you think they won't break their lease if Arlington Heights is ready to go?
They won't.
Pennies on the dollar.
See ya.
What else can we do to sweeten the pot, make it more attractive? We got
baseball.
We got all the rackets. We got your dope. We got your gambling. Maybe we could legalize prostitution in time for the DNC. I'm not sure.
But that would be, you know,
I don't know if we can get
another
that
revenue,
done.
Another, you know, taxable income.
Well, also make it fun for all the Democrats.
Pot's legal here. They'll love that.
Coming to town. All the Hollywood types coming for the DNC. They're going to want their prostitutes.
Right.
So, I mean, you know, you got to accommodate the people that are coming to town for that tourist dollar.
You know what would be sweet?
Yeah.
J.B. Pritzker running for president.
Well, yeah.
It's
well,
2024. Anybody he wants to do it in his hometown.
Well,
you know?
Of course, that's what he wants. I hate to have anybody disrupt that by, you know, doing something like voting him out of office on November 8th. Course, no. Dan in Lake Zurich, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, Dan, I think you just made me realize why I got this check in the mail yesterday from the state. It's a income tax rebate of $100 and a property tax rebate of $300.
Congratulations.
That, either somebody's trying to buy my votes, which I won't vote for them anyways, or they're trying to get the DNC here.
Yeah. Oh, they're trying to buy your votes. Hey, Dan, the $400 that you got, that basically holds you harmless in terms of your out-of-pocket expenses under J.B. Pritzker?
No. It didn't help with at all. I mean, that was from 2021 that they rebated this money.
Yeah.
It wasn't from 22, so it hasn't helped with anything with the pandemic or inflation or gas prices. Or
how about your property taxes? You guys get a property tax rebate.
Yeah, those still went up this year, so no, it didn't help with that either.
Did they go up by more than $300 by any chance?
This year they didn't, which I was surprised. We had luckily only about $100 increase this year.
Oh, okay.
No, you're lucky.
Yeah, all right. All right, very good.
Yeah, and what, I'm very lucky because
mine went up $1,200.
What are your property taxes as a percentage of your home value, roughly?
Well, let's put it this way. I'm a third of an acre. My home value is approximately $350. Tell you guys that, and I'm paying around $8,000 for a third of an acre. I also own my escape property up in Wisconsin, where I own 40 acres, where I paid $2,500.
Looky
there. Thanks for the call, Dan. Yeah, that $300 property tax rebate one time, while you're paying all time more than 2% of your property value in property taxes, which destroys your equity in a compounding way year over year. That's what Dan in Lake Zurich is describing. So, but enjoy that $300 because that's property tax relief, according to J.B. Pritzker, while your house is being used as collateral for somebody else's pension. Uh-huh. Brian in Valpo.
Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, the answer is bribery, I believe.
What's missing?
The Democrat Party wants to bribe the city to get in there, and then the city wants to bribe the Democrat Party to come to them. So they don't know who to bribe who in this situation.
Yeah. Yeah, it gets confusing. Thanks for the call, Brian. Yeah. By the way, did you see this story, too? We talked quite a bit about the chaos surrounding the Mexican Independence Day celebration, the city not properly planning for the crush of people they knew would be downtown, mm-hmm. and just general chaos, certainly on Friday
down.
Night.
They stood down.
So now we get this report. As overwhelmed Chicago police struggle to handle massive Mexican Independence Day crowds downtown Friday and early Saturday, routine 911 calls piled up across the area because no cops were available to take them. Just before 3 a.m. on Saturday, most of the calls for help in the two districts that patrol the area were more than 4 hours old. But then a high-ranking Chicago police leader made quick work of that problem. He ordered a dispatcher to code out any calls more than 2 hours old that didn't involve a physical injury. So, for example, if you reported a burglary in progress, a person with a gun, a group of people loitering on private property, an auto theft, a purse snatching, or anything else that didn't involve someone being physically injured, now you know why the cops didn't show up. The order was given by CPD Chief Angel Novellez and was broadcast on the local police district radio frequency at about 3 a.m. on Saturday morning after a unit finally became available to handle calls, and the officer asked the dispatcher where they should go. I have a 2-hour, 59-minute-old person with a gun in River North, the dispatcher replied, and so on and so forth. So he just coded them out, just eliminated those calls.
Just eliminated. And you know who would have been affected by that? The scream lady. And,
well,
I mean, if that would have happened.
Physical injury.
Well, I mean,
that did not involve a physical injury. So, again, person with a gun, like in River North, that actually happened. Group of people loitering on private property. Your car got stolen. Your purse got snatched. Anything not involving a physical injury, your home was burglarized. We just wave off those calls. We just wipe them clean. And this is not inconsistent with what we know happened in 2021, where more than 50%, more than half of all 911 calls got no response from police. That is yet another indictment. The improper planning, and then having either making or having to make, because of resources, calls like this CPD chief did to just tell people who are victims of crime but weren't physically injured, you're SOL in this city. Sorry. That's what you're paying those property taxes for? Hey, but you got a $100 check if you're under $200,000 in income, income tax rebate, and a couple $100 for your property taxes,
and $100 a child.
As your physical safety deteriorates almost faster than your property value does.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one, Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today. 773-467-5630. 773-467-5630. 6:30 or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So on 60 Minutes on Sunday night, as Mr. 10%, the big guy, President Biden, walking around with Scott Pelley at the auto show in Detroit, and they weren't wearing masks.
Oh, my God.
Did you hear me, COVIDians? The big guy was not wearing a mask. He said this.
The pandemic is over. We still have a problem with COVID. We're still doing a lot of work on it. But the pandemic is over.
The pandemic is over.
Where were you when you heard the news?
But is it?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. You can also reach us on our text line, 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
The public health portion of the pandemic is over, even for the COVIDians, at least the top COVIDian. I mean, not some of the more rabid COVIDian ideologues in the public health community, the Eric Topols of the world and so forth. But for those who have to live somewhat in the real world, like politicians, it is. And so
it's not over.
The public health portion is, but the Cloward Piven portion is not. The Cloward Piven portion continues. Why? Because, well, whether they are actually executing that strategy or not, I mean, whether they're doing so consciously or they're just doing so instinctively, I don't really know, but that's what's happening. You know, we talked about this before. You know, other WAGs have talked about this. You know, this was a big topic of interest for Glenn Beck for a time. I think it was the first book he read, so he was very interested in what those two Columbia social workers had to say some almost 60 years ago now. The Cloward Piven strategy was this. A lot of this is what they wrote back when they came up with this perspective. A lot of people that have that are eligible for welfare benefits don't access them. So you need to push for a huge welfare program enrollment, have a huge push for enrollment. And that push for enrollment will overwhelm state and local budgets, and that will awaken the federal government to expand the welfare state nationally. And what do you get? You get a huge welfare state with a whole new class of people that become state dependents, or at least state devotees. And this is generational. And you know what those state dependents are? They're loyal Democrat Party voters. And so what do we have here? What do we have here? As the Wall Street Journal opined, why hasn't the president also declared an end to the public health and national emergencies? If the pandemic is over, so is the emergency. But the administration continues to extend the public health emergency first declared in January of 2020. We're going on, you know, coming up on 3 years.
Yeah.
The reason is almost certainly money. A March 2020 COVID law enables the government to hand out billions of dollars in welfare benefits to millions of people as long as the emergency is in effect. This includes more generous food stamps and a restriction on state work requirements. It also limits states from removing their Medicaid rolls from their Medicaid rolls, individuals who are otherwise no longer financially eligible. One estimate suggests that the cost of ineligibles being on the Medicaid rolls, $16 billion a month.
Billion?
$16 billion a month. And by the way, at the state level, the biggest single category of state expenditure is not on K-12 education. It's on Medicaid, where in Illinois, thanks to Obamacare and now the expansion under these COVID protocols, nearly one in three Illinoisans are Medicaid eligible. I mean, it's a complete budget buster. Also, only weeks ago, Mr. 10% used a separate national emergency declaration related to the pandemic to legally justify canceling a half a trillion dollars, that's $500 billion, in student debt. As the Wall Street Journal concluded, Biden wants it both ways. He wants to reassure Americans tired of restrictions on their way of life that the pandemic is over, they can get on with their lives, but he also wants to retain the official emergency so he can continue to expand the welfare state and force states to comply. Right. Bankrupt the country, or at least reshape the country. Make it more government-centric. Make more, you know, newly mint more state dependence. And that's the kind of quickest path to a Democrat-Socialist majority, certainly at the federal level, and given the largesse that's flowing to so many of these states, at the state level, too. What we were just hearing, our friend from Lake Zurich who called before Mike Scott's newscast. Oh, I just got my rebate checks in the mail.
Yeah, whoopty.
Illinois, as our friend Ted Dabrowski, who will be on with us at 7:30, bottom of the 7 o'clock hour, as he and the Wire Points folks calculated, $186 billion of COVID relief that flowed to public and private in Illinois from the feds. And again, order of magnitude, that's four times the state's annual budget, round numbers. You see what they're doing? So you see why the COVID is over, resume your way of life, except your way of life is a little bit of a new way of life for a lot of you because we're going to try to fold you into the state. And so for those who were mau-mauing, people like me suggesting that this expansion of state power is not something that is going to spring back like a rubber band. They're going to hold on to it. They're going to use it to their advantage. What did Gavin Newsom say right as we were going into lockdown after the 2 weeks to slow the spread? What did he say? This is an opportunity to transform our economy. This is an opportunity to transform America is what he was saying. And he wasn't the only leftist. He may have been one of the only leftists saying it, but he wasn't the only one thinking it.
It's a Cloward Piven strategy.
Tony, Downers Grove, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Oh, Dan, this isn't about welfare. They do this with voting as well.
Yep.
In the form of mail-in ballots. And now if you try to challenge it or make logical rules.
Voter suppression.
Yes, it's voter suppression. Hey, Dan, on a side note, I read yesterday that Dick Durbin's complaining that his son was pilfered via PPP. How ironic. $140,000. I mean, really, Dick? Let's count how much you pilfered the state.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call, Tony. I mean,
we changed the way we vote. Now, and you can be a lifelong mail-in ballot voter now. You can sign up for that, too.
I just hope...
You would have never have done that without COVID.
I just hope... there's been a lot of focus on the voting, and rightly so. There's been less focus than there should be on the money as the means to creating dependency. That is a cultural change. It will be hard to unwind. I hope people are thinking about this and talking about this. On the good news front, with respect to COVID,
what?
Precedent-setting case in New York, hopefully at least for public, for first responders in New York. New York cop who sued the city over the vax mandate cannot be fired for not having gotten the jab, according to a Manhattan judge. Should be allowed to keep his job. The city gave the Brooklyn cop no explanation for why it rejected his religious exemption application. And this is the first such ruling in an NYPD cop's case fighting their possible firing over the mandate. And here, you know, this is the same deal in effect here in Chicago for police and fire and city workers. And one wonders if... not only that, the pending litigation or people that will file suit to try to protect their jobs if they're fired, but also the questions that now should be asked. You just heard Mr. 10% say the pandemic's over. Why is there still a vax mandate on city employees?
Or in New York City, your son or daughter cannot play sports if they're not vaccinated. That mandate is still in place. We still have tens of thousands of members of the military, soldiers, that they did not take the COVID vaccine and they're out of a job. I mean, why are we doing this? Pritzker, and we'll talk to Ted Dabrowski about it too, has signed his 34th disaster proclamation.
Well, right. We know why he's doing it, because it's
federal fund,
the money. Yeah, the money.
And the votes for the union, especially the CTU. And teachers throughout the state, because if you're sick, if you're sick with COVID, it does not count against your sick days. And you don't even have to prove that you have COVID. You just have to say that you have it, excuse me.
Follow the money and follow the money grubbers. That would be the public sector unions. I'm talking about AFSCME. I'm talking about SEIU. I'm talking about the teachers' unions. The people actually in charge of this state. Pritzker's just a figurehead for the unions, as have been previous Democrat socialist governors, as is the entire General Assembly, at least in the power structure, including a lot of Republicans, but particularly the power structure, those actually in charge making decisions. The decisions are all being made by the public sector unions, including on other members of public sector unions, meaning COVIDian public sector unions imposing their will on police and fire, not to mention the trades. So maybe police and fire, especially fire more so than police, and the trades at the rank and file level, maybe you want to get hip to that reality if you're not, because I know your leadership is pushing you to, you know, stay the course and vote for this same Democrat socialist power structure incredibly. Maybe you want to take judicial notice of what's actually happening and who are the real shot callers. Mike in Plano, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, guys. Dan, you know, with what you've been talking about, this state apparatus here in Illinois is so large, I can't even watch a YouTube video anymore without seeing a Pritzker ad talking about abortion. Yeah. And I was wondering, because I want to get your honest take on where do you think this race stands, and do you think Pritzker's pretty much a shoo-in at this point? Because in my opinion, I think Bailey's campaign is floundering. I mean, he's just not catching fire, in my opinion. I was hoping he'd kind of have sort of a Trump-like message that could reach people to, at least give him a shot. But
Mike, you're looking at this too narrowly, aren't you? So
I should hold out hope.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes.
The race is tightening. And, so to take a step back, you know, you see something from Pritzker on YouTube and people like Fatalistic throw up their hands. We had a retired police sort of make the same argument. We're making international news on the Safety Act. You think that's good news for Pritzker and Lightfoot? It's not. You think they want to be talking about this? No, they don't. You think that all these legislators now that are coming out and trying to recast their vote and recast the Safety Act that are bailing water, you think they want to be in this place? No, they don't. And so so now you've got people's attention on this issue in a way that they're paying a lot more attention than any other issue anybody's broadcasting. And so when you look at just specifically what the candidate is doing, you have to look at the landscape generally, what people are talking about, all the other actors on the landscape that are not necessarily the campaign proper, including my PAC, but also on the left on their side. And, you know, it's just a lot more complicated picture. It's always was an underdog race. It is an underdog race. It was always going to be an underdog race in Illinois, no matter who the nominee was. But what people are finally starting to pay attention to issues of their economic and personal security and making assessments about who's been in charge and where their economic and personal security stands. And that is a good place for us to be in terms of driving people's thoughts that will inform their decisions as early voting starts in a couple of weeks. And then, of course, on November 8th, the election itself. So, you know, spend less time worrying about what Bailey's doing and more time making sure people are zero focused on making the election a referendum on the person in charge. And that's J.B. Pritzker. If it's a referendum on J.B. Pritzker, then he has a very good chance of losing. If it's Bailey isn't Trumpy enough, or Bailey didn't do this, or Bailey didn't do that, or Bailey's not this, or Bailey's not that, and you get people talking about Bailey as opposed to just, hey, he's a safe place to land. He's a pragmatic guy. He's a problem solver. And he's principled and he's a straight arrow. And we don't have any of those things right now in J.B. Pritzker or, frankly, in most of the rest of the state in terms of state offices. Then you're in a good position. So that's what I would implore people to do in terms of how they assess the race. Stop just saying, he doesn't have a chance because I'm not seeing a groundswell. Robert Cahaley, just the Trafalgar pollster, just tweeted out a thread about this, too, about, the 2016, the unseen Trump voter that most pollsters didn't pick up. That is present again here in 2022. Because in a way that perhaps they're even more subterranean than they were in 2016, because of course every Trump voter and person who isn't down with the big government COVIDians is been called a domestic terrorist and being targeted by the FBI if they show up to a school board meeting. So you may not see evidence of the attitude that is as pervasive as Cahaley is suggesting it is, and I'm suggesting it is. But these issues what we are talking about right now at the national level, thanks to DeSantis and Abbott talking about border security and folding that into the national conversation, in addition to what's bubbled up to the national level from local on personal safety and crime in big cities. I mean, not to mention, people's household incomes being diminished considerably by inflation and the Dem socialists not wanting to stop there. This is the recipe for a 1994, a 2010. Will it happen? I don't know, but I know that this is the sort of landscape on which that sort of seismic shift can happen. So that's what I would say. Thanks for the call, Mike. I know it's a lot, but it makes sense, and it needs
to be repeated.
It needs to be detailed because it can't just be one ad or one this or one off color comment or that. It's got to be conceptualize what's happening, understand what is happening, and then make an argument into that. Don't just focus on something that's idiosyncratic. Don't take the bait of their distractions away from center mass here. And center mass is economic security and personal security. Economic security and personal security. And how have the people in charge around the country, how have they been doing to serve your economic and personal security interests?
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630, and learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630, or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Let's talk about the border and the forthcoming prosecution of Ron DeSantis and Greg Abbott as human traffickers.
Wow. 312-642-5600, turnkey.proanswerline. Grab a line or text us at 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
I wanted to pick up on something that we were talking about right at the end of last hour per a call from our friend Mike in Plano about, where Darren Bailey's campaign is and where the governor's race in Illinois stands. The reason that DeSantis and to a lesser extent Abbott became national figures even before they started busing and flying migrants to sanctuary places for them. In other words, rich white enclaves. Before that, the reason is because of the policy positions they took. And the way they took them, yes. The quality of arguments that Ron DeSantis made, his unyielding nature to irrationality in the face of the common sense that he's offering, yes. But the policy positions, they took up particular fights. And same goes for Trump. So I just want to get, I'm always trying to get people off this, and it's difficult because I understand these, you know, the policymakers have to take human form. The policies don't exist by themselves as abstractions. But this personal Jesus stuff, I want every politician to be like my favorite politician. I want every politician to be like Trump, or I want every politician to be like DeSantis. They're not going to be. Everybody's going to be different and have different attributes and different deficiencies. But the underlying policies they're fighting for, that's the key. And if the underlying policies they're fighting for are the policies that are dominating the discussion, and from the point of view of those policymakers or prospective policymakers, that's good news. Whether or not you're in love with their approach, whether or not you think they're a charismatic figure or a good speaker or not. You see? So that's what I just need. People need to think a little bit more broadly than just, you know, how is a particular, and this doesn't just go for Bailey versus Pritzker, it's congressional races and legislative races too. Think a little bit more broadly. And as the, with the idea that the politician is the vehicle for the policy. Where do the policy debates stand? How are we doing? And how is this person contributing to how we're doing or not? Get, you know, with apologies to Depeche Mode, get off of the personal Jesus stuff. You know what I mean? All right. Not of my personal Jesus, Ron DeSantis. Ron DeSantis was on.
He's our savior.
With Hannity last night to talk about Martha's Vineyard. And, well, I'll tell you what, before we get to him, let's get to the prosecution's case.
Okay.
So Fat Don King, Ellie Mistel, who's quickly become my favorite legal pundit in particular, but just generally pundit of the left on the cable news networks because he's so unhinged. He resides at MSNBC. I think he actually lives in the studio. Ellie Mistel making the legal case for charging Florida Governor Ron DeSantis with kidnapping.
I think we need to start there. First, I don't want to, you know, give people false hope. Not every evil, sadistic, twisted, bigoted, racist thing these people do is illegal. Some of those evil, sadistic, racist, bigoted things are just allowed in this country. This is a country that has cut its teeth on the forced or coerced relocation of non-white citizens throughout American history. This ain't new. When Joe Biden says that it's un-American, nah, sorry, Mr. President, this is strangely American, using non-white people, weaponizing them, and carting them around the country. This is what this country has done in the past. However, in this specific case, I think especially when you look at the immigrants sent to Martha's Vineyard, we have reports that they were lied to, that they were tricked, that they were induced with false promises to get on planes and then shipped someplace where they weren't told where they were going. That, to me, is a violation of the federal kidnapping statutes. The legal term of art is inveigling. As I, you know, as I think most people can kind of, their horse sense can kind of understand. If I roll down and find a bunch of teenagers and I say, look, kids, hop in my van. I'm going to take you to Disney World. Oh my God. And I take them to Busch Gardens. You know, and I take them to old Williamsburg, that's kidnapping. I didn't take the kids where I said I was going to take the kids, right? So I think that in this case, Ron DeSantis told these people, including children, that we'd taken to one place, Boston, which would have services where they would get expedited work visas, where they would be have housing, and then sent them to a different place. That is kidnapping. And the person that we need to understand that is, unfortunately, at this point, not Ron DeSantis, not Greg Abbott. We need Merrick Garland. Once again, to understand that and bring the full weight of the federal government down on these people.
If only Merrick Garland wasn't so busy investigating parents who show up to school board meetings, maybe he'd have the time. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Look, Ellie Mistel knows about pulling up to a bunch of teenagers in a van and taking them to Disney World.
Yeah, just offer him some candy to get in the van. To
he
take
knows
to
what
Disney
he's. I think he knows what he's talking about. That's why that example was so top of mind.
So I'm then not, you have the sheriff in.
Well, wait. I'm not actually sure that. First of all, Elie Mystel is a lawyer. Seriously, I'm not sure that's exactly right. If you take a bunch of people in your car, telling them they're going to Disney World, and you go to Busch Gardens, that constitutes a violation of the federal kidnapping statute. Yeah, I'm not sure that's actually true, but regardless of whether that absurd example is accurate or not, that's not what happened with the two governors in question.
So Bexar County Sheriff Javier Salazar, he opened up a criminal investigation into those two flights that were chartered by DeSantis. He claims that they were lured, and yes, he used the word lured, under false pretenses, that one guy gathered it up 48 other people and said, you know, they're going to give us their promised work and other solutions to several of their problems.
Mm-hmm.
But that's complete opposite of what DeSantis's people are saying. They said that they were told multiple times that they were going to go to Massachusetts.
We'll hear from DeSantis momentarily. Now DeSantis is going to be, he's soon to be charged with a terrorist attack, it looks like, because there's an additional report. One of the planes used in DeSantis's Martha's Vineyard excursion, currently scheduled to travel today from San Antonio to Florida to a small airport near Biden's home in Delaware.
Oh, boy.
So that'll be an insurrection. What's tomorrow's date? September 21st, 22nd?
Yeah. Today is the 20th, so tomorrow's the 21st, yes.
Yeah, tomorrow, they'll need a 920 commission to investigate Ron DeSantis sending migrants to Joe Biden's home, I assume.
But by the way, this Baxter County sheriff, he's a Democrat, just so you know.
Imagine that. Yeah. Here's what Ron DeSantis said about Martha's Vineyard on Hannity last night.
Millions of people since Biden's been president illegally coming across the southern border. Did they freak out about that? No. You've had migrants die in the Rio Grande. You had 50 die in Texas in a trailer because they were being neglected. Was there a freak out about that? No, there wasn't. You've had criminal aliens get across that southern border and victimize Americans, killing some, raping some. Was there any type of outrage about that? No. And then, of course, we know fentanyl deaths are at an all-time high. Where's that fentanyl coming from? It's coming over the open southern border. It's only when 50 get put into Martha's Vineyard, which wasn't saying they didn't want this. They said they wanted this. They said they were a sanctuary jurisdiction. These were people who were basically destitute and then put in a situation where they could have succeeded. But that was all virtue signaling, and not only did they not welcome them, they deported them the next day with the National Guard. Give me a break.
I mean, this hate has no home here. We're so loving, but then when they get to their front doorstep, they bust them out right away. The next day, they weren't even there 24 hours.
The CNN article about this, this is so delightful. I mean, these are just the most unserious people on the planet. The CNN, the headline is, "The experience changed us." Martha's Vineyard residents talk about their interaction with migrants for 5 seconds. After sharing hugs and teary goodbyes with roughly 50 migrants who had arrived unexpectedly, this affluent vacation island and the volunteers who sheltered them in an Episcopal church carried out tables and chairs, packed food onto trucks, and folded portable cots. A familiar quiet had descended by Friday afternoon on the tree-lined downtown block of Martha's Vineyard, where Jackie Stallings, 56, could not stop thinking about a young Venezuelan who sat with her at St. Andrew's Parish House the night before.
It was such a tight bond, a close bond, one she'll never forget. Maybe they could become pen pals.
During their whirlwind 44-hour visit this week, migrants, the young Venezuelan woman left an indelible mark on their accidental host in this isolated enclave.
We'll host you, but you have to leave tomorrow morning by 10. It's on their terms. I can't stand this.
We're so sad to leave you go, to watch you go. We're so sad you have to leave, you know, under the direction of the National Guard. Please don't go.
By the way, two National Guardsmen to each person, to each asylum seeker. So they didn't have one, but they had two, like, shuffling them out. Oh, my God. This is classic. I mean, I really hope they can remain friends.
I want them to have a good life. I want the journey they experienced and the hardships they experienced to have been worth it for their families. I want them to come to America and be embraced. As they're, you know, calling Apache helicopters in.
Calling in the National Guard.
To have them airshipped out. Oh, I mean, this is just, they're just the best. They're just the best people. DeSantis, by the way, the whole thing about they were told they were going to Boston, we've got jobs for it. The whole thing is that's ridiculous. It was all voluntarily. They signed waivers. They were given essentially like care packages for the bus ride. DeSantis explained to Hannity they were given a map of Martha's Vineyard.
You are
with
here.
A list of
Estoya Key.
List of services, you know, contact numbers for services available on the island and so forth. DeSantis went on to make the point about these Martha supremacists who could have assimilated the 50 migrants if they wanted to, but, you know.
Sean, there are jobs available in Martha's Vineyard. There is lodging available in Martha's Vineyard. Had they lived up to their what they build themselves at as a sanctuary jurisdiction, they could have absorbed those people without a problem. But here's the thing. They said they didn't have housing. They said they couldn't accommodate. Like, let's just say that's true for a minute. Well, what does that mean for these poor towns in Texas? What does it mean for these other places across the country that are seeing influx? What does it mean to these small towns that Biden has dumped so many people in? And so I think what we've been able to do is show that this border is a disaster. Biden has failed on this as much or more than on any other policy. And now people are talking about it. And we want solutions as Americans. We want to make sure that Trump's policies of remain in Mexico can be reinstituted so we can get control over what's going on down there. But this immigration and border, I think, is now a front burner issue. And I think this is one where Republicans have the advantage without question. So run on it. And then if we do get majorities in the Congress, Sean, they need to do something with that power. To hold Biden accountable on this issue.
Bingo. George Monee, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, Dan, got to disagree with you on the whole, if they drop them off by Biden's house, it's an insurrection, man. No, it'll be Pearl Harbor is what it'll be. It'll be an attack on Biden's homestead.
Thanks for the
call,
George.
I just wonder how it might be less than 48 hours. So if they bond with the Delaware residents, if it's, you know, when they kick them off, I hope it's going to be
cheerful goodbyes. More cheerful goodbyes.
Life-changing experiences.
So sorry you have to go.
I'll get them out of here.
Clay and Wheeling.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. I caught that, the Martha supremacist. I really enjoy that term. That is a fantastic term. You should trademark that. Second, I understand the stunts, but I'd rather see the people deported. And third, I don't know why you guys are worried about DeSantis and Abbott being charged with kidnapping. I mean, cash bail, they'll be out by tomorrow. They'll never be tracked again. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for the call, Clay.
I love it. Keep bringing them.
Rick.
Don't stop with two flights.
Rick, Downers Grove.
Hey, good morning. Hey, based on the stories that Martha Vineyard residents were so happy that they were there and so sad to see him leave, I wish Ron DeSantis would make an announcement that if, hey, 50 had this effect on you, just think what the next 5,000 I send are going to do to you.
Exactly. Think how many more lives that could be touched and the indelible mark that will be left.
It's so embarrassing.
From your time with the Venezuelan migrants. Ross Barkin, writing in The Atlantic. Says Democrat Pauls like your Adamses and your Hochuls and your Lightfoots and your Pritzkers, they're making a mistake. Embrace. Mm-hmm. Since the pandemic-induced crime spike, not pandemic-induced, but, you know, this is The Atlantic.
Whatever.
Trump Republicans have invaded against big cities, taking up incendiary and racially coded 20th century playbook to throw Democrats on the defensive. Sure. Few prominent Democrats have offered an adequate counterargument. Now political leaders who care about immigrants should declare affirmatively and loudly, yes, send them here. Send them to New York, Chicago, L.A. Send them to Cleveland, Detroit, and St. Louis. And send them to the cosmopolitan cities trapped in red states that will welcome migrants. San Antonio, Houston, and Miami are enriched by refugees and their children, people of flood oppression for a better life in America. The last sentence is the only thing that's true. They are enriched. Absolutely, they are enriched. But there's a way to do it, and there's a way to not do it. And there's a way to call out virtue-signaling ninnies. And there's a way to let ridiculous, unlawful policies like sanctuary, city, county, state stand. We're not going to cooperate with the federal government. We get to choose what federal laws will abide and which ones we won't abide. What is redeemable about that? How is that consistent with the land that these oppressed people fled to because they wanted to live in freedom? If you don't have the rule of law, if you have the rule of men, then you're turning this country into one of the countries they fled. Aren't you, Ross Barkin? Of course you are. But I do. I agree. Tell them. And why won't they? Maybe Ross could help us answer. Why won't they do that? Why won't all these mayors and governors do that? Yes. Yes. Send them here. Eric Adams is overwhelmed by 11,000 people over 4 months in a city of 8.4 million people with billions upon billions in resources, public and private.
And the numbers are out for August, 204,000. And coming into tiny towns like Eagle Pass, Texas, again, population 22K, they had 50,000 in July. That's double of their population. I mean, they couldn't handle it, so they bust out, and these are coming from Democrats.
It's showing you how
they need help,
how incompetent and dysfunctional, how incapable big city governments are, because they're all run by Democrat socialists, in addressing any sort of unexpected problem, how slow they are to react, how lacking a sort of the entrepreneurial problem-solving orientation these big city politicians are. Uh-huh. Daryl,
I-55. Hey, Aunt Dan and Amy, I just want to say I love your show. I listen to it. I drive truck, so it's one of my biggest things I do. I got a different perspective on it. I lead a not-for-profit in Honduras, and one thing that this immigration thing has done to Honduras is really devastated families, because sometimes they'll send their fathers to take a chance to try to gain some money or going to help support their families, and they'll come to the United States and they desert their families. I can tell you there are thousands of families in Honduras right now without any kind of financial support or anything like that. And some of the ministries I work with are just really trying really hard to help these people. And it's a whole different perspective. But just having our open borders really is killing a lot of families in that Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador.
The Northern Triangle. So, yeah.
You know, people die every day making this trip.
It's a great point. Thanks for that call and that point, Daryl. It is a great point. And you know who else has made that point is Bukele, the president of El Salvador, who said, I don't want El Salvadorans going up to Mexico and to the United States. We want our talented people to stay here. We want families to stay intact, to Daryl's point. And this is do you want to talk about fraud or a unethical inducement? The declaration of open borders and then the chaos that reigns at our border and in our country generally because of the open border policies, de facto open border policies of the left. Absolutely right. And again, the El Salvadorian president saying the exact same thing. Ralph Rantoul.
Yeah, good morning. I think that they should all be issued. I thought about it while I was waiting. I think they should all be issued maps to the stars' homes, a paper cutout mask of Joe Biden, and a Monty Python-esque bad phrase book so that if they think they're saying thank you, it says something like, Joe Biden says I'm not here.
Thanks, Ralph. You know, I think there was a story about Texas Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick having some sort of document suggesting that Hollywood could be a next drop-off point for migrants that were being moved about the country with the help of Greg Abbott. Again, and voluntarily so, despite these ridiculous, you know, charge them with human trafficking, charge them with kidnapping, assertions by the left.
Well, what the Pritzker administration, what they're doing in Mayor Lightfoot, they're trying to find that one person, you know, because we have 750 now here, but the first busload that came, they tried to find somebody who said that they were taken here against their will. The person wanted to go to California. They wanted to go to Hollywood. Well, yeah, we're not a travel agency, lady, you know, so get a grip. So they're just trying to find that one person that will say what they want them to say. But they all signed the paper. It's in English and it's in Spanish. So they know damn well where they're going.
We're overwhelmed here in Illinois by 750 migrants who've been bussed up from Texas. Overwhelmed. Says everything that you need to know about the disingenuousness of people like Lightfoot and Pritzker and incompetence, which is a real nice twofer.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. See Larry Elder, Brandon Tatum, Alex Berenson, and many more at Freedom Summit Chicago. Tickets available at freedomsummitchicago.com.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Again, we talked about the speed yesterday, but let's talk about it some more in depth with our friend Jim Uriel from Fox Business momentarily. Joe Biden, Mr. 10% on with Scott Pelley, 60 Minutes. Terrible interviewer. He was asked, you know, hey.
Subject matter.
Talk about inflation. Yeah, this is basically the question, the quality of the questioning. And here's the big guy talking about inflation and economic growth. Take a listen.
Inflation rate month to month was just just an inch. And we're growing the economy. It's growing in a way that it hasn't in years and years.
How so?
We're growing entire new industries. 695, I think it is, or 85,000 new manufacturing jobs just since I've become president of the United States.
Mm-hmm. We've had a GDP contraction the last two quarters. So in your Biden to English dictionary, a growth now means contraction, just so you can keep up. Now, something else Joe Biden tackled in that interview we didn't get to yesterday, but I do want to get to. It's a delicate topic.
What?
Mr. 10%'s mental acuity. You know, he's the eldest president we've ever had.
Right.
You know? And so is he up for the job? And I think after hearing this answer,
I think you know.
You'll be clear on the issue.
How would you say your mental focus is?
Oh, it's focused.
What?
I have trouble even saying to myself, my own head, the number of years. I no more think of myself as being as old as I am than fly.
I no longer think about myself as being old as I am than fly.
And then he kept talking about pudding.
Well, I mean, it's a matter of, you know, that old expression, the proof of the pudding's in the eating. I mean, I respect the fact that people would say, you know, you're old. Yeah.
Well, that's actually an expression.
I know. No.
That's an expression, but I no longer think of myself as old than fly is not an idiom that I'm familiar with. And a lot of people didn't catch this part, too. You had to go to the 60 Minutes outtakes, you know, the 60 Minute Extra past the 25 minutes they spent on him.
Promote that during the show.
And he told, the big guy, he told a delightful story about going to buy shoes one day.
I needed a new heel for my shoe. So I decided to go to Morganville, which is what they call Shelbyville in those days. So I tied an onion to my belt, which was the style at the time. Now, to take the ferry cost a nickel. And in those days, nickels had pictures of bumblebees on them. Give me 5 bees for a quarter, you'd say. Now, where were we? Oh, yeah. The important thing was that I had an onion on my belt, which was a style at the time. They didn't have white onions because of the war.
Yeah, so, you know, the story went on from there. You can catch the rest.
All right, well, the bottom line, yes, he might not be running again for re-election.
Jim Uriel, Fox Business Analyst, proprietor of Brandt's and Palatine, joins us now. Jim, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
How are the heels on your shoes?
It's a delightful. I mean, it's fun. You know, he's a good storyteller, whether it's about corn pop or getting a heel for a shoe.
Or hair on his legs.
So, Jim, the economy is growing because Joe Biden said so. There's hundreds of thousands of new manufacturing jobs, and inflation ticked up just a smidgen from zero in August to 8.3%, or in zero in July to 8.3% in August.
No, that's not what happened. That's not the way I saw it. Even now, you know, we've had two consecutive quarters of negative growth, and now the Atlanta Fed GDP Now model is bringing down their estimate for the next quarter to near zero. So, I mean, we're in this weird spot that it just seems like he feels that he can just say something and it becomes true. And again, you know, I don't want to, this bandwagon about his mental acuity might be falling. I mean, he's obviously an old guy. When my father got to be 90 years old, he just thought to himself that he could just say something and have it become true. I don't know if we're at that point now, but it certainly seems it. Like where did he, and again, so this inflation thing, it amazes me because all the government has to do, the federal government, is not do a couple things, just not be stupid. The one thing would be not to monkey with input costs like energy. Well, that ship has sailed. They've done that. And the cover-up is currently going underway where they're still selling the SPR, even though you know some of the long positions had been forced out. Two, don't try to inorganically increase wages, which, by the way, is one of the pillars of modern monetary theory, that you want to do that coming out of a recession. And it's the absolute wrong thing to do because that could get us caught up in this, you know, the wage cost price spiral that could, you know, conceivably be never ending. So then they've already done that. Give money away in the form of UBI. You guys read the Sun-Times yesterday?
Oh, yeah. Universal basic income. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's great. And people think that that's somehow a gift. That's a yoke, people. And it's inflationary. It's unbelievable. They've done it twice. They're doing it with the student loan thing as well. And then let's borrow money to increase the national debt for big spending bills, like the one that was ironically called the Inflation Reduction Act, and then also the forgiving student loans one. So they're really doing all the wrong thing. The only thing that's left for them to do to really mess things up is going to be to institute price controls a la Nixon in the 70s. So
we're doing that in the healthcare sector under the quote unquote Inflation Reduction Act.
Of course, yeah, they're starting it already. You could tell they wanted to do it. Remember, like, a couple months ago when they were pointing at these companies and saying that it's their fault for the inflation. That's just that's the first step. It's kind of like a throw out a dog whistle to see who says, yeah, it's their fault. And then all of a sudden you're capping the prices. And again, for people who don't understand this, well, let's say like rent control. But for rent control, always inevitably has to make prices of rent go higher. And the reason is because the year before it's even instituted, developers are starting to smell it out and starting to pull back on developing in areas that are going to institute rent control. And then by the time it happens, the supply is already starting to decrease. And a year into the whole rent control thing, rents have gone much higher. This is a basic law of economics that really can't be broken.
The issue on inflation tackled by a couple of eggheads, one an econ professor at Dartmouth, the other a senior economist at Berenberg Capital Markets, right in the Wall Street Journal, about the Fed sort of winging it with inflation rather than having a strategy they're pursuing based on a real hard-headed understanding of the scope of the problem. One of the things they suggest is that Feds have been overly optimistic that inflation would recede. And in clinging to that rosy outlook, they completely misjudge how the government's unprecedented fiscal stimulus, that means spending, would affect aggregate demand and inflation. They go on to say inflation and services will persist even as the prices of energy and goods decrease. This is the risks that are present. The price of shelter, as you were just mentioning, the single biggest component of consumer inflation, rose 6.2% over the past year, accelerated to an annualized rate of 7.6% over the last 4 months. And it takes a while for those changes in home prices to be reflected in rental costs and owner-occupied rental equivalents. And so even by nuking people's brokerage accounts, if the Fed continues to do that, you know, getting to a Fed funds rate at 4.25%, it still doesn't mean they're going to kill this monster they've unleashed based on what these two gentlemen are arguing.
No, not for the next 6 months, but I will push back on them for what could happen 6 to 8 months from now. And the Fed winging it, of course the Fed's winging it. The Fed's always winging it. I mean, you go back a year and a half ago and they were still buying it. Just to put it in perspective, last June, the CPI had already printed over 5%. The real estate market was obviously, inarguably, way too hot, and they continued to the tune of buying about increasing their balance sheet by $1 trillion, including buying 240 billion mortgage-backed bonds to support the housing market. So excuse my rant for a second, but the second part of that I'm going to say is that the Fed is going to overshoot. So they mentioned the owner's equivalent rent part of the CPI, which tends to lag by 6 to 8 months. There's no doubt in my mind that real estate market has changed considerably, that it has to. Mortgages went from 3% to above 6% in about 9 months' time. So the damage is being done there, which, again, it needed to be done. It should have never been allowed to have so much fraud. So what's going to happen, in my opinion, is the Fed is going to – now they're scared. They're genuinely scared that they missed the boat about stopping inflation. So they're going to hit it hard. I don't think they're going 100 basis points tomorrow. I think they're going 75 because the market kind of has dictated that to them. But I think they're going to keep going and keep fighting a foe in real estate that keeps showing up in the CPI that probably would be defeated regardless of what they do, and they're going to worsen the recession going into the middle of next year. Does that make sense that I described that?
I mean, it makes sense, but is there – so that's what they're going to do. Is there another path they could take that gives a higher likelihood of the so-called soft landing that everyone seeks?
No, because the only way they could take a different path was if the federal government – decided to help them instead of fighting them like they continually do. Like the federal government, you can't be doing the things they're doing and not have a goal of keeping this inflation going. And maybe it's because they just want greater and greater tax rates. I don't know if you saw the latest data on taxes. They've collected taxes on the federal level to the highest percentage of GDP. Maybe it's been equaled one other time in our history. So congratulations to them for really, really increasing the taxes they're bringing in, because I'm sure they're going to do wonderful things with it like they always do. But the only way the Fed could engineer a soft landing is if the federal government agreed to be on the same team, and that's not going to happen.
Well, what about going the other direction then? If that's the problem, you've got no fiscal restraint on the other side of the house, then get the plane on the ground. Come in for a harder landing right now and go more aggressively with interest rates to really, you know, whether that creates some short-term pain in the marketplace or more significant short-term pain in the marketplace or in the markets, I should say, or not, get it over with.
I think that's the plan, genuinely. I think that's what they're trying to do right now with front-loading short-term interest rate hikes. But also remember, too, that beginning of September is when the plan was to let $95 billion of long-end bonds roll off the balance sheet, essentially forcing long-end rates up as well. So it's a bit of a 1-2 punch they're doing right now. And I think they are perfectly comfortable with destroying asset prices. I think they're actually welcoming it a little bit too, because that's another way to decrease demand, is to take money out of people's pocket. One way the government likes to do it is through taxes, but the Fed has to do it by destroying the equity markets, cryptocurrency markets, real estate markets, and make people less willing to spend money to bring down inflation. But I think that I think that they probably shrugged their shoulders and said there's no other way. I mean, in the last month, the government has passed two big spending problems that will increase the debt. So we're getting no help from the government. The Fed has to do what it has to do.
So where are we going to stand with Bitcoin and the S&P at year's end? How much further are they going to be down from where they are now?
I actually think the picture in about a month will change a little bit too. I think that the Fed will start to talk about when they're going to stop doing this, because we're going to start to see the signs of a recession much more clearly. I think the S&Ps can probably revisit those lows of 3,600, the June lows, but I don't think much lower than that. Now, people who've been around as long as we have, we think about the big implosions in tech stocks in the early part of the century and then real estate. We have to remember that those bubble busts were built up over time and were based on this huge amounts of leverage. People were mortgaged up to buy additional tech stocks, and the same thing in the real estate market. And it took a long time to work our way out of those things because so many positions had to be sold. I don't think there's a ton of people who are like, you know, mortgaged out their house to be long in the stock market right now. I think we've had two different shocks in the last 2 years. The first one down 36% right after the onset of the pandemic, and then this year of just trending lower. So I don't think there's the fuel to really have people panic and everybody sell out of weak hands and drive it down 40%. So I think we're fine in the stock market-ish.
Fine-ish, so treading water or slightly lower, but nothing catastrophic from where we are now.
I don't think it's anything catastrophic. And again, when you want to add in the fact that there's probably been about 14% inflation and the stock market was at its lows down 26%, you could basically add in that 14% as additional losses too.
Yeah.
So it's almost kind of mildly catastrophic what we've been through already, I guess is more my point. You know, there's been a lot of wealth that's been destroyed through inflation and through asset prices collapsing.
Over across the pond, our friends there in merry old England, the new PM, Liz Truss, this is an interesting statement. Maybe somebody in the Western world is starting to get it. When she was interviewed recently, she was confronted with a chart showing that her proposed national insurance cuts would predominantly advantage the rich. And PM Truss said, "What I'm about is growing the economy, and growing the economy benefits everyone." That seems like a basic statement, but that is a revolutionary statement in these times.
In the darkness of night, we see the glimmer, the first flash of somebody who might be on the right track. If we could, the thing that hurts us the most is this pettiness and jealousy towards the people who really do well in a growing economy. And if we can get somebody who doesn't feel that way, that's just amazing to me. That you put me in a little bit. Again, this is just one flash in the darkness, but that's a big thing. Hopefully the pendulums always swing both ways. Like even in our state of Illinois, you can obviously tell we're on this massive decline. I stopped taking the L. And again, I know that the safety, there's an economic component to this too. So as you guys know, I feel like I can talk about anything. But anyway, so the pendulum is swinging wildly with this Safety Act that's being being brought into play for next year. So at this point in time, you got to sit back and say, okay, make as many mistakes as you want because you're already past the point where this is going to explode and going to come back at you. Why not just applaud it at this point in time?
Jim Uriel, Fox Business Analyst, proprietor of Brandt's Restaurant in Palatine as well. Jim, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560 The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. The great disintegration that continues in America's major cities and counties. The topic here. We talked a little bit about this yesterday with the city of Denver's universal basic income pilot program for the homeless in particular. We have them here. We got your reparations in Evanston. We got your universal basic income play at the city of Chicago level.
Yeah. $500 a month for 5,000 families.
But we don't give enough attention and credit to Toni Preckwinkle. Toni Preckwinkle, the Cook County Board President, she birthed Kim Fox from her loins. She gave us Kim Fox.
She spawned her off.
She was such a detestable, odious candidate. She turned over the keys to City Hall to Lori Lightfoot.
You know what's kind of embarrassing about Preckwinkle, though? If you go to these press conferences.
That she looks like Grady from San Francisco.
That the whole family's there. You got mom and dad, Lightfoot, Pritzker, Aunt Julia, grandma, Toni Preckwinkle. When they're over, she kind of loiters near the lectern because she wants to be interviewed and nobody wants to talk to her.
Probably,
it's really embarrassing.
Probably intimidated by her Bill Walton-like size.
I'm here. Anybody want to talk to me? I'm here.
Yeah. Well, Toni and the rest of her board, announced a universal basic income program of their own at the county level.
Oh, so we have the city one now. Oh, what's this one called?
No.
Where do I apply?
This is just a universal basic income program. Mm-hmm. I'm surprised you haven't already applied. So you're in on all these scams.
I got my EBT cards.
You got your COVID lunch money. You got your other welfare state benefits.
But we ate so well back then. Remember, I would buy filet mignon and...
Sure.
And you guys would eat it with us. $900 a month.
Somebody else's dime. I mean, that's living. Yeah.
There's crazy money.
Under the program at the county level, the county will send monthly payments of between $500 and
$3,250. What?
Yeah. Now we're talking about real money, huh?
I'm sorry. Can you repeat that?
That's a lot of filet mignons. $500 to $3,250 to its residents who successfully apply for 2 years. At $42 million, Preckwinkle boasts, this is the largest public-funded guaranteed income initiative in American history. Oh. We made history, Cook County. Congratulations. 312-642-5600, turkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turkey.pro text line. Always at the tip of the spear when historical achievements are at bar is Cook County. Congratulations, all of we Cook County residents. Well, I want to be the
first to, you know, abolish cash bail too.
Uh-huh.
We want to be number one.
We've already done it de facto, and this pilot program of abolishing cash bail and the rule of law in Cook County was now scaled statewide under the Safety Act. So again, leading the way, Cook County government. Wonderful. Here's how it works and who's eligible. Eligibility is open to anybody 18 years or older with a household income at or below 250% of the federal poverty level. That's about $58,000 for a family of three. So a family of three with a household income of $58,000 is eligible for payments of between $500 and $3,250
a month
for 2 years.
What?
That threshold, by the way, $58,000 for a family of three, about more than one-third of Cook County residents are eligible. More than one-third are eligible.
Well, how are they going to decide who gets the money?
More than one-third of, and how many residents do we have in Cook County? Like 3.5 million?
3 million, I think.
Uh-huh. One-third. So let's just, I mean, it's actually 36%. Let's say 1.2 million.
Oh, I was going to do the math.
Yeah, well done.
You beat me. 5 million?
Oh,
Mike?
5 million?
5 million are in Cook County?
Are you sure? That's not an inflated number. I thought everybody left.
Look at he's not Mr. Fake News. That's real news.
All right, let's just so 5 million. So call it, we'll be
2.5. No.
2.5 is 50%.
That's 50%.
Yeah.
So 1.9 million? Maybe I should 1.9
times 3.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
But this is why you got the welfare state benefits.
Oh.
So don't go getting
good
at
my
math.
Kids
you're
going
to lose your benefits.
No, my kids have a Hispanic last name, so everybody thinks we're poor.
Uh-huh.
That's nice, too. You sick of that racket, by the way? Hispanics out there, Latinos?
Maybe they think you were poor less of the time if you weren't on so many welfare state programs. Did you ever think that? Mm-hmm. All right, so we're talking about, let's just call it $1.5 million,
okay,
for ease of purpose. 1.5 million people would be eligible in Cook County. Oh, but you say, well, wait, Dan.
You have to write an essay?
Dan, what don't you understand about a pilot program?
Okay.
Just a pilot program. Okay. Well, Tony said this. Our promise to Cook County residents is to make this program permanent in the years to come. The name of our pilot was chosen purposefully because the word promise reflects an understanding of broken promises of the past and our intention to right those wrongs today and into the future. So it's a pilot program. It always starts as a pilot program. Nothing is so permanent as a temporary government program or a pilot program, to borrow from Milton Friedman. And then it becomes a permanent thing. And by the way, the $42 million, where do you think that comes from? COVID cash. Of course. And so where will the money come from? When
Kohl's cash,
it's a permanent program with 1.5 million Cook County residents eligible. Where will it come from when the COVID cash is gone? Oh,
312-64.
Ooh. somewhere.
312-642-5600.
Rich.
Turnkey.pro answer.
We'll tax the rich. The top 2%.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll do that and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what we'll do. Ooh. Uh-huh. Yeah. UBI for, you know, just outside middle-income families. I mean, the household income in the state is 63 grand. 58 grand, you're eligible for a UBI and 500 to 3250. One third of all Cook County residents. Real excitement, real enthusiasm about it from Tony, just as you got real enthusiasm about it from Triple Threat, just as you got real enthusiasm from Evanston for reparations, just as you get real enthusiasm for Jelly Belly for all of his largesse. I'm not talking just personally, I'm talking about other people's money. And when it all goes away, how will it be sustained? Those rebate checks you're getting now, who's enjoying their property tax or income tax rebate?
Yeah, we'd love to hear from you because they're hitting your, they're hitting your bank accounts today, or you're getting the paper check today.
It's exciting.
Well, but 7 weeks to go before the election. I mean, let's buy some votes. Come on.
I haven't gotten so excited about a $100 income tax rebate check since, at least since I got $100 to take the COVID jab.
Oh, that's right.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
It's good, isn't it? Temporary tax relief in the hundreds for permanent tax relief in the thousands. Is that a good trade? I mean, you know, I'm not great at math. Is that a good trade? The promised guaranteed income pilot. It's a pilot, but it's a guaranteed promise. And you're going to sign that check. Hey, but we're going to suspend the inflationary increase in the gas tax for 3 months. So it's all, we're square. It all comes out in the wash, right? John in Bridgeport.
Yeah, guys, I'm just calling to remind you, please don't take the eye off the target on this one. It's in regards to the Chicago Police Department. And, Amy, this is where you come in. We have boss shakeup on the job, and I want you to remind people in the higher-ups, you have a sergeant still on the job that opened fire on an unarmed autistic kid 2 years ago, and he got away scot-free. And now you have a policeman in a shootout, and he's... Kim Fox filed criminal charges against him. Please remind them of what about fairness in all this. Please. All thanks, right. Guys.
Thanks, John.
Thanks for calling.
Dave Barrington.
Hey, good morning. Love your guys' show. Listen to you every
Thank
day.
You. Are you on the Cook County side of Barrington?
Yes. Well, just on the very tip and edge.
You're Cook County, though?
Oh, Cook County, yeah.
All right. Did you apply for the Universal Basic Income Program yet?
No.
All right.
Do you have to write an
my
essay?
Income,
yeah.
Income is more, but...
I mean, seriously, like, say you have cancer or something?
You have to write an essay about how the money that you get from the county will be used to promote diversity, inclusion, and equity.
Yeah, and equity, yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Oh, right. I'm going to have my five-year-old start that little...
There you go.
...message. I guess, yeah, like I said, my point is we should have returned all this COVID money to reduce the deficit, but gosh, that would be fiscally responsible, wouldn't it?
Exactly. And also not fun. That's no fun. Thanks for calling, Dave. Instead, we get to spread it around. Everybody gets to wet their beak, Dave. It's all good. This mobocracy we have, right? Paul Plainfield.
Hey, I just wanted to say, you know, now that I got my money for my Tesla and, you know, other people got their money for the Rivian, it's now time for the poor people to get theirs.
Yeah, that's true. Thanks for the call, Paul. Exactly. Everybody gets a cut. Something. Everybody gets cut in. The cut me in or cut it out. I get it. You know, you give me a Tesla, sure, we can give some of the downtrodden $500,000 a month. What's the big deal? No problem. But plenty to go around. And when there isn't, we just print more. Frank, Arlington Heights.
Well, $42 million divided by $1.5 million is $28. I mean, this math doesn't work. Are these people complete morons? they not pass third grade math?
Well, this is
I know it's per family, per family, but I mean, it's still, I mean, for 1.5 million people, $28.
Well, no. But this is a pilot program, so this is just for a thousand households, a few hundred households initially. But it's a promise to make it for everybody to get it who's eligible down the road. That's Tony Preckwinkle's promise to you, Frank, in Arlington Heights, Cook County resident. So, hey, you know, you could have something coming your way.
I'm going to apply.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm going to apply. You know, all of us should apply and do a reverse Clovard pivot, and overwhelm their system. You know, have everybody in Crook County apply and then, you know, see if they can handle that.
Yeah.
Communists. That's what they are.
Yeah.
Bolsheviks.
Thanks. So you're not on board with the program?
No, he's applying for the program.
Yeah, but he's applying as an insurgent, not as a celebrant. And you need to be a celebrant.
Yeah, I don't celebrate this stuff. There's nothing from these people to celebrate. They're some of the most horrifying people. They are. They're communists. They're Bolsheviks. That's clearly what this is.
Thanks for the call, Frank. But yeah, $1.5 million, $42 million for 1.5 million families doesn't go very far.
No.
So I just leave you with that question about, you know, where's the money going to come from to sustain this latest gambit while you're sustaining your K through 12 school systems with blank checks, while you're sustaining your ever expanding state welfare programs, starting with Medicaid, with 1 in 3 Illinoisans Medicaid eligible thanks to Obamacare plus the COVID. When the federal money recedes, there's going to be a lot of ugliness washed up on shore here, isn't there?
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Insert Democrat socialist here.
Runs the Democratic House for 30-plus years running. He's promising this and he's stealing that. Where can you get that kind of money? He's using your house like his own piggy bank. Gang. You ought to know by now. You can pay off your house here in Illinois, but you can never keep up with the taxes. Oh, how it's always been the plan to have a taxpayer pay no doubt. Not a matter of if anymore, but when. You're moving out.
Dan and Amy, that theme music means it's time for our weekly conversation with Ted Dabrowski, president of WirePoints. But before we get to Ted, I did have a question, Amy, since he is one of your people. This train seal that was appointed to replace the aging train seal to the city council. So Michelle Smith can't blow the horns anymore, so she had to retire. And Lightfoot brought in this Timmy
Knutson,
but it's being pronounced Knutson.
Knutson.
Why is the K not silent?
I don't. It's
he's Swedish,
it's not,
right?
Right. I think he's Swedish.
Uh huh.
Knutson. Knut. I don't know why.
Why
it's
is
not,
it not silent?
Why does that bother you?
Why
so
is it Knutson? Why,
why
is
are you
Knutson?
So bothered by this? And you keep hounding me. You're chasing me in the cafeteria, asking me about the Knutson.
I'm interested in the etymology of the.
I don't know.
Of the non-silent K. I'm fascinated by your people, your culture.
I'm more fascinated how he got the job. I mean, apparently he's a Bitcoin advocate. Who's not?
Finally, somebody's advocating on behalf of Bitcoin.
And he helps the LGBTQ asylum seekers.
Yeah,
from Mexico and other places. Now, if you're straight, he won't help you. But if you're gay, he will help you.
He touted his unpaid work on behalf of transgender asylum seekers. I'm sure there's a ton of those coming in from Venezuela. A lot of clingers coming in from the Northern Triangle countries, South America.
We got a stage 5 clinger. Let's go.
It's the wrong clinger. Yeah.
I know.
Yeah. Hey. Okay. All right. Well,
he's going to make everything better.
Yesterday, Governor Spaulding joined the fray. Maybe he wants to do a series of debates with DeSantis like Newsom does. Join the fray over the busing and or flying of migrants from states like Florida and Texas to states like New York and Illinois. What did Spaulding have to say?
Because we have 750 asylum seekers now in Illinois. And Marianne Ahern asked him not once, But Marian Ahern asked him twice, is the border secure? Answer the question.
They're trying to sow chaos. We're trying to truly care for people
yeah.
who need their human rights upheld.
And are the borders secure?
In my opinion, we need to have comprehensive immigration reform, and we need to make sure that we are securing the borders in every way that we can.
Presidential uh-huh. timber right there.
Uh-oh. That's a question he cannot answer because he knows the borders are not secure.
Ted Dabrowski, wirepoints.com, all things Illinois policy related. Ted, thanks for joining us.
First good morning, guys.
First question, do you know the mystery behind the non-silent K in Timmy Knutson's name? Follow-up, is the border secure?
I have no idea on the first question. Don't know why. Maybe it's something special.
Okay. What about the follow-up?
The follow-up, you know, it's I think, become ludicrous, right? That we're freaking out over 750 people coming here in Illinois when we just had record numbers of people pouring over the border, you know, more than 2 million people. I looked in April, we had in just 1 month alone, 234,000 illegal immigrants cross the Southwest border. That's massive. That's 1 month, you know, more than 2 million in a year. And what's interesting about all this, Dan and Amy, is that, you know, of those 2 million people who cross, assuming that we get our share of the population of the country, our share of those illegal immigrants, that's about 80,000, you know, Hispanics making their way to Illinois every year. And we know we get more than that because we have a larger Hispanic population than other places. So we already have, and this is one of the reasons Chicago doesn't shrink, is because you have this big inflow of people. So for us to be, you know, freaking out over a few people when, in fact, you know, we have probably 100,000 people coming a year.
We need these people because we've already paid to have this many people wandering around getting their universal basic income checks. So somebody might as well get the money since productive Illinois people are leaving. We might as well have new people come in and join the ranks of the unproductive because that's what the government wants them to be.
Well, yeah, and it's also, you know, Governor Pritzker has been fighting to say that Illinois is growing, that its population is growing. The only reason it grows is because you have Hispanics coming in, not because we're attracting businesses and people from the rest of the country. We, on a net basis, we lose tons of people every year to other states. So it's really fascinating, the whole dynamics of this, and then of course the hypocrisy behind it all. You know, he and Lori Lightfoot wanted to push the sanctuary city, sanctuary state issue. But now they don't like it anymore because they can't handle it. So they should make up their minds.
And also, I mean, yesterday we had two big things. President Biden saying the pandemic is over. But then Pritzker signs for the 34th time a COVID disaster proclamation. Now, when is this? It's just mind-numbing.
When does it stop? Yeah, I mean, when the money stops, period.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's again, you know, more COVID money. I think, you know, Pritzker's still getting more food stamp money, more Medicaid money. Never mind the inflation that massive federal spending has done. You know, you got to wonder, probably those people who are getting checks, more checks because of Pritzker's emergency declarations, you got to wonder whether it's all wiped out and how much is wiped out by inflation. You know, the same people that are getting some money are having to pay, you know, massive amounts more for groceries and gas and you know, energy. So it's a lot of, you know, this is just a combination of failed policies we're just going through here.
This is 900 days, though, of Illinois living under emergency rules. And will it stop?
Yeah,
December, is he going to stop it after the November election, or when do you think that
the money runs out, which is unclear. What is unclear about this? When the money runs out.
Well, Dan, it's certainly a money issue, but I always like to say that it's more than just money because, you know, these disaster declarations allow him to continue to issue executive orders of the ones that he likes when he wants to do something, you know, use a little bit of power. You know, he's done the emergency declaration for the monkeypox and now for the illegal immigrants.
But it's still it's all about the money. It's all about, you know, executive orders so he can spread money around at his leisure. And by the way, speaking of trained SEALs, they're not just on the city council, as if anything he's done would fail to get a majority from the supermajority of Democrat Socialists in the General Assembly.
Yeah, I mean, this is the other big point, is that the General Assembly has done nothing to stop him. You know, they like giving him the powers to do whatever he wants. You know, by the way, Dan and Amy, Indiana passed a law. So they got rid of their emergency orders, you know, a few months ago. But they passed a law that allows them to continue to get the food stamp money. So there are ways of you know, taking away the power from the governor and still legislating things if they want more money. But, you know, we haven't done that here.
You know, you guys crunch a lot of numbers and you put up graphs and tables and you distill data, but you don't come up with sort of the innovative solutions to the problems that really plague us, like, say, Switzerland does. Switzerland's environmental minister, Simonetta Sommaruga, we can reduce energy consumption by 15% this winter in Switzerland, she says, if people could just have showers together. And, you know, I mean,
You want to take one for the team, Dan?
Well, you know, government promoting group showers. Oh, where have I heard that? People showering together, 15% off energy costs there. What do you got to reduce the cost of energy this winter, Ted?
Well, you know, that might be an energy reduction issue, but also might be a population increase proposal too, right? So they're shrinking of people, so maybe that's, you know. I think it's the problem of, you know, all these countries, and Illinois included, right, going so fast on these, you know, getting rid of their carbon-based energy, and they have no plan to make up for it with these new sources of energy. So now they're scrambling and coming up with, you know, again, crazy ideas because they've got nothing left.
Well, I mean, that Crane story, which has gotten, first of all, I can't believe it was in Crane's, the anti-business magazine. Some editor must have been asleep at the switch. But the Crane story last week, that by the end of the decade, Illinois will not be energy independent because of the, you know, Green New Deal eco-freakism of this governor and the General Assembly when it comes to emission reductions on the order of Gavin Newsom in California. So now we're going to be more beholden to the marketplace for our energy needs, you know, and it gets cold in the winter in Chicago. I don't know if you know.
Yeah, then we'll just be importing that same energy from some other state, paying a lot more for it. A lot of that will be coal-based or natural gas-based, and so, you know, kind of defeats many of the purposes of what they were trying to do here in Illinois, other than, you know, just people get whacked more with higher costs. I mean, it's been fascinating, the stories we've heard of how much, especially southern Illinois, how much more people are seeing their energy bills, 50%, 100%. It's really scary. We plan on doing a story on a company that just talked about how they were just getting destroyed.
What's been your reaction to the bailing of water going on by Democrats who voted for this no cash bail, defenestration of the Police Safety Act, and are trying to, with the help from their comm shop, the Chicago Press Corps, trying to recast it consistent with the rhetoric you're hearing from Pritzker and Lightfoot?
Well, I think they're stuck, and you're starting to see, you know, Pritzker mention, we could do some tweaks, even though he didn't say which ones. But I think people are digging in, and of course it helps when Democrat state's attorneys are also pointing out the problems. There are so many problems, and we're going through it in quite detail right now. There's so many conflicting terms in the language. Of course, I'm starting to think that it's even worse than we're saying, because we've talked a lot about non-detainable people. I think a lot of the people who are in theory detainable may be coming out as well, given some of the language. So there's a lot of problems in here. They've removed some key language on community protections. And when you remove this kind of language, it opens the door to lots of confusion. I think you have a lot of, you know, judicial discretion, which will be all over the place. People won't understand what they're doing. Judges won't know what the right rules are. And so I think we're moving in the right direction. There's a lot of pressure. There needs to be a lot more, because they will try to hang on to a lot of the language. But there's a good possibility here of really unwinding a lot of this if we keep the pressure up, because it's a really bad bill.
Yeah, and in so many places in contradiction with itself. But, I mean, they're just simple things that people can readily understand. They see it happening in Cook County on a daily basis. But things like the trespass issue. So if somebody trespasses on my property or in my business, I can't have them removed. They get a ticket, but the police won't do anything to remove them from my property and keep them off my property. That's up to me after they're ticketed. Things like that that put people in confrontation with one another they don't want to be in, they resonate.
Oh, geez, and then when you hear what happened last night or over the weekend, where Chicago police started not responding to
911 calls.
Yeah, 911 calls. If there wasn't some kind of, you know, bodily harm, they wouldn't respond to them. So imagine now you've got a guy sitting in your home, and we've got all these problems we have. You have a change in discretion. You got the police worried about how should they respond. And you've got things like what's going on in Chicago where they don't even respond to the 911 calls, or they say, hey, we're too busy. We're going to decode our system so that it doesn't cover some of these crimes that aren't so dangerous. And it's a real mess. And it's I think people are waking up to it. It's like you've said, it's a referendum on whether, you know, if we can't have safety, what else, you know, what else do you need?
But if we're paying taxes and they're coding out 911 calls, I mean, isn't that illegal at some point in time?
Well, I don't know.
I mean, that's a dereliction of duty, but obviously, I mean, that's...
Well, it's a resource issue, though, too. I mean, that's, I'm sure, what you would hear from police. It's a resource issue. What do you want me to do? I don't have the police to send out to these calls.
Right. Well, we had gunshots on our shots fired on Saturday night, I believe it was. And, you know, my neighbor called 911. Why? Nobody was injured that we know of. And they're not going to, and police are not going to come. And guess what? They didn't come. As I told her, they're not going to show up.
Let's be clear. This is a leadership issue, because the reason that happened is because you lost control of your streets. You lost control of you know, cars being able to move through the city. And you had people locked up and blocked up on highways. It's a disaster. And when that happens, of course, the police can't make it places. You can't even get through the city. I think, Dan, you described your inability to get through the other night.
Yeah.
For years now, the man has suffered. One time he had to come into the suburbs and get a...
I had a Dukes of Hazzard my way through the loop, you know, up on two wheels a little bit, jumping over cars and stuff, but I got home.
But one time you had to come out here to the suburbs and get a hotel room.
That's
and
true.
And there's horror story after horror story where people were told, have your identification out, you know, to prove you live on that street to get through. One lady waited almost 8 hours going down different streets trying to get home, and they wouldn't let her into her home, even though she had ID showing that she lived there.
Yeah, we reported recently there were 400,000 911 calls where there was no police to be dispatched, and that was in 2021. So we have to see how bad this thing gets, you know, as crime worsens every year right now.
Hey, one other thing before we let you go. I got this email from a friend. New Trier, that's where you are, New Trier Schools. Don't forget about K-12 and what's happening in K-12. Don't forget about that. That's an issue, too. New Trier High School students filling out this survey, which includes questions like, I would like to participate in the white anti-racist affinity group. Yes, I identify as white, and I'm interested in joining the white anti-racist affinity group. Or no, I'm a white supremacist. No, I added that, but that's basically what they're saying. The white, in case you were wondering what the hell I'm talking about, the white anti-racist affinity group, the group provides white students, or those who identify as white, with an opportunity to deepen their personal understanding of what it means to be a white ally when it comes to anti-racist work. No indoctrination going on at New Trier there, Ted.
No, you know, they don't teach critical race theory in Illinois.
Right.
This is a really good example of what they're doing in schools. They're separating them into different groups. You know, you got your different ethnic groups or different race groups. And then the whites have a real trouble because, you know, they don't have a group. So they've created a white affinity group. And that way, you know, you're an anti-racist white group, which really begs a question. If you don't join that white anti-racist group, does that mean you're a racist? You know, there's all kinds of signaling going on. It creates pressure. You know, it's funny, though, that the school complained that there weren't enough people participating. So, you know, it's hard to know what that means. But it's really sad when they're trying to bucket people and force young people to bucket that way. And then, you know, what kind of discussions do you have when you break out into different races? And then I guess you just complain about the other races. And then what, you're supposed to get together and like each other again?
I think the kids' houses – the white kids' houses that who do not join the white anti-racist affinity group, I think they should be marked in some way so that everybody in the community knows who the racists are. But that's just me.
Well,
I'm just trying to build tolerance like those administrators at New Trier.
That's effectively what it is, right? If you don't join, what's wrong with you? Or, you know, are you one of the bad kids, one of the bad guys? It's just the wrong way to do things, and I think people are becoming more aware of it. But they're still doing it. They want to hide it, and of course, you know, we need to keep exposing it.
Yeah. Would you like to join the white anti-racist affinity group, or would you like to have a burning cross installed in your front yard? Simple. No, it's no big deal. Do whatever you want. Ted Dabrowski, president of WirePoints, wirepoints.com. All things Illinois policy related. Thanks, Ted.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, the state of religious liberty in the country. We've mentioned this case before, some real-time developments. Yeshiva University has decided to suspend all campus clubs after the Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court, denied its bid to block a LGBTQ plus campus group inconsistent with the Orthodox Judaism that is at the core of that university's mission and education. The university will hold off on all undergraduate club activities while it immediately takes steps to follow the roadmap provided by the U.S. Supreme Court to protect Yeshiva University's religious freedom, said the college, their case now winding its way through courts in New York State after having initially received a stay on a state court order by Sotomayor. When the full court took it up, Roberts was on the wrong side, as he almost often is. And so now Yeshiva University has to battle it out in New York State Court before perhaps returning to the Supreme Court, depending on what happens. Somebody who's just incredibly no stranger to battling it out in state courts, that is, at the Supreme Court, and then back in state courts, is Jack Phillips. He's the owner of Masterpiece Cake Shop and the author of The Cost of My Faith, How a Decision in My Cake Shop Took Me to the Supreme Court. He is back in court. This has been 8 years that Jack Phillips, who's just a small business person, local cake artist in Colorado, has been harassed by the Lavender Bund and the activist representatives of the LGBTQ plus crowd who look to force compliance, force celebration on people regardless of their faith, and then use the state to force them to renounce their religious convictions. And so it's happened again. First, it was with respect to making a cake for a marriage redefinition ceremony. That's the one that went all the way up to the Supreme Court, and he won. You think that would be the end of it. And you'd be wrong. Now he's in court battling the Colorado Civil Rights Commission again because he won't design a cake celebrating a gender transition event. Jack Phillips joins us with his attorney. He's also had to spend 8 years with an attorney following him around every year, right? And that everywhere. That's not fun either. No. It's not costly because I think ADF does it pro bono. Good for them. But it is. And it's annoying to walk around with an attorney for eight years, even though I'm sure Ryan Bangert is a wonderful person. Ryan Bangert is senior counsel and VP of legal strategy at ADF, Alliance for Defending Freedom. Jack, Ryan, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having us. It's a pleasure.
So, Jack, just sort of describe what's happened now.
Well, first of all, at Masterpiece Cake Shop, we're in Denver, Colorado. We opened up 29 years ago, and with the intent of serving everybody who comes in, because that's what I want to do. I'm in retail, but I can't create every cake that people ask me to create because some cakes have messages that I just decline to express. And that's what happened back in 2012 when two men came in and asked us to create a cake to celebrate their same-sex wedding. And I believe that a wedding cake by itself has an inherent message. If you walked into a conference room and saw a cake in the corner, you'd know it wasn't a business meeting. You'd know instinctively that it was a wedding reception, that a marriage was to be celebrated. And so I told these two men that I couldn't create a cake to celebrate their same-sex wedding, but I would be glad to create other custom work for them, sell them anything in my shop. That wasn't good enough. They stormed out of my shop swearing at me and flipping me off and went to the Colorado State Civil Rights Division, filed a complaint. And then they took that complaint up, and we ended up, like you said, at the United States Supreme Court back in 2017, where we won 7-2. But at the same time, we had gotten a call the day that the court announced that they were going to take our case from an attorney here in Colorado, asking us to create a cake that was blue on the outside and pink on the inside. And those colors were to signify and celebrate gender transition, changing from a man to a woman. So we told this attorney the same thing that I told the two men. You know, be glad to create other custom work for you because we serve everybody. We love to serve everybody and create cakes for people to help them celebrate. But that was a celebration that we couldn't participate in because I believe that God created male and female. And so that wasn't good enough for this person. They filed a complaint with the state again. The state sued us and then dismissed the charges. And now we're in our third lawsuit with the it's a civil lawsuit with the attorney. Suing us in a civil case, which goes back to trial in a couple of weeks. But there are other cakes, many other cakes that we won't create because of the message. It's never the person that's asking for the cake. It's always the message that they ask for. For instance, we won't be making Halloween cakes. We never have, and Halloween's coming up in a few weeks. We don't create cakes that are un-American or cakes that would insult anybody or cakes with profanity on them. So it's the message of the cake. It's never the person. So,
do you know? Did you ever thought about? Have you ever thought about getting out of the business? Because they're not going to leave you alone ever.
Or the state?
No, I love this business. I got into retail because I love serving people, and I love doing what I do. We opened the cake shop with the name Masterpiece Cake Shop because Masterpiece says art, Cake Shop says cake, and I want to use the cake as a canvas to help people celebrate important things in their lives. Baby showers, graduations, birthdays, you know, all kinds of things. So, no, I love what I do.
What about where you do it?
I've been in Colorado all my life. I was born and raised about 2 miles from where I work, and this is the only place I want to call home. This is where God's put me. And despite the politics here, it's a wonderful place to be, and no, I wouldn't move, and I wouldn't change my vocation.
And we've talked to you before about the impact on the business, but sort of the latest update on the business. I think the last time we spoke to you, you know, it was sort of down to you and your wife and maybe one of your children helping out at the shop. And I just wonder what the toll on the business has been.
Well, the day that the two men came in and asked us for the same-sex wedding to create the cake celebrating their same-sex wedding, I had 10 people on the payroll. That dwindled down to 4, including myself, and we've got about 6, mostly part-time, 2 full-time and part-time, which is part-time is like 12 to 16 hours for most of them. So the business has changed, but we're still not doing wedding cakes while we're in the court battle, because every time I do a wedding cake, it opens me up to another lawsuit. And like you said, Alliance Defending Freedom has defended us for 10 years now, pro bono. They've never charged a dime, and they run on donations. It hasn't been free for them. It just hasn't cost me anything, but it's been an expensive 10 years for them, and sure. Mm-hmm. So if people have extra money to send around to somebody that they believe in, Alliance Defending Freedom would be a great place to send it.
Well, Ryan's got to eat too. You know, he's got to be able to. Yeah.
I mean,
right.
Yeah. So I assume that because, you know, you're the center of all this controversy there in Denver, you're the only cake shop, you're the only bakery in Denver,
sure.
Are you?
No, there's actually another really nice cake shop just across the intersection from us. I think according to the Supreme Court records, there were 67 bakeries in town that not only would be glad to do the cake, but a lot of them have advertised in gay periodicals and those kind of things. And I gladly serve gay people. I gladly serve transgender people. I have a friend who's transgender who was in the shop yesterday. When we were in court last year, we had a former gay activist who testified on our behalf that I've always served him graciously and welcomed him kindly, and he's a friend of mine. He testified that, Jack serves everybody, but he can't create every message. So that was good to hear, too.
Yeah, you're just not, according to some, you're just not allowed to believe what you believe. That's basically what it comes down to. I mean, that's Ryan, bringing Ryan here as the senior counsel, VP of Legal Strategy at Alliance for Defending Freedom. I mean, that's basically what the argument from the opponents is, which is why this, you know, when you took this up to the Supreme Court, you had a 7-2 decision, as Jack just mentioned, which, well, you know, by definition crosses the ideological divide on the court.
Yeah, that's right. And it's interesting, our opponents in these cases frequently argue that the principle at stake in these cases is whether Jack can discriminate against certain people because of their sexual orientation and gender identity. And that's not the case at all. I mean, you heard Jack just say he serves everyone gladly, regardless of their sexual orientation, gender identity, or anything else. The issue in these cases is whether the government can force people to speak messages and create messages that contradict their deeply held beliefs. It's simply a matter of forcing people to speak. In fact, the plaintiff in the most recent case asked Jack to create this cake to celebrate a gender transition for the express purpose of testing Jack. And in the words of the plaintiff at trial, on the record, he said he wanted Jack to correct the errors of his thinking. That was the purpose of the cake.
Right.
He forced Jack to change the way he thinks. And that is unconstitutional, it's unlawful, and that is not consistent with the principles of free speech and free expression of religion that our nation was founded on, and that's why these cases are so important.
And this civil case that you're now facing, I mean, how does this not get laughed out of court and, frankly, the attorney bringing it sanctioned?
Yeah, well, incredibly enough, there's another case that's going up to the U.S. Supreme Court right now that I think illustrates the point. It's called 303 Creative versus Elenis. Same law, the Colorado anti-discrimination law. This case involves a website designer who serves everyone but won't speak certain messages. And the federal court in that case, found that the website design did constitute constitutionally protected speech. Creating a website is speech. So the court said, sure, that's protected by the First Amendment. But the interest of Colorado of forcing persons in Colorado to speak messages that the state considers to be not hateful or not discriminatory is so strong that the state can force people to say things. And so it's really just it's a clash of ideas. It's a clash of principles. Does the government have the power to force people to speak messages that the government believes are approved and appropriate or not? The Constitution says no,
right.
But increasingly, our governments say, yeah, that's exactly what governments should be doing. And that's just simply not right. That's completely inconsistent with the founding principles of our country.
And so, you know, even as just as a civil matter at the local level, I think the importance of this case because of what's happened over the past decade is obvious. But I mean, just state it for us. I mean, if you have courts rule that, as you just mentioned, rule on the side of the First Amendment allows for the government to not time, place, manner, but content discriminate on speech, then you know that's a precedent that's being set there that you'll see other courts pick up and run with. Then that we get to a real precarious place when it comes to those rights enshrined in the Bill of Rights.
That's right. And that's exactly why this case should concern every American, regardless of your political beliefs, your ideologies. If the government has the power to force you to speak government-approved messages or to prevent you from speaking messages the government doesn't like, well, then all of our freedom is threatened. And that's why this case should matter to every American, regardless of your political stripe.
He is Ryan Bangert, Senior Counsel and VP of Legal Strategy at Alliance for Defending Freedom. And as Jack mentioned, they've been representing him pro bono for the last decade and representing all of our interests if you believe in living in a free society. In this case and many others. So Alliance for Defending Freedom, if you want to support that worthy organization. And also, if you're in the greater Denver area or not, order a cake from Jack Phillips while you're at it. Jack Phillips, owner of Masterpiece Cake Shop, author of The Cost of My Faith, How a Decision in My Cake Shop Took Me to the Supreme Court. Jack Phillips, Ryan Banger, thanks for joining us, gentlemen.
Thanks for having us. It's been a pleasure.
Yes, thank you. And they joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. the answer. America First with Sebastian Gorka. Today at 3, right before Sean Thompson at 4 on AM 560. The answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Yeah, we always talk about, not always, but you know, we revisit these topics of men versus women and their treatment in society today, like real time.
Yes.
Because we understand there are political interests that want to pretend that women still don't have the franchise, much less equality of opportunity when it comes to education or
work and, you know,
job opportunities, right. And, you know, we have our friend Mark Perry, who's an economist over at the University of Michigan, and he does the Carpe Diem blog, which is always very good, you know, has some fun with this when he does, if in response to equal pay, quote unquote, equal pay day, equal occupational fatality day, right, and the number of women that would have to die on the job to catch up to men who die on the job and,
right,
you know, it's various industries dominated by men.
Yeah, it's because we choose not to be coal miners. I admire them, but a lot of ladies would not go down there and do that on a daily basis.
Right. Lumberjacks and so forth. Also, on the flip side, and this again, Mark Perry is good at this, bringing us adjusted household incomes when you contemplate things like continuity in the workforce. Also brings us the number of degrees earned in various disciplines, men versus women, undergrad and postgrad, and, you know, dominated. Post-secondary education is dominated by women in terms of obtaining degrees, with the exception of very few disciplines like computer science, hard sciences, and engineering. And that largely, again, comes down to affinity. Interest. And so I'm interested in this new book by Brian Kaplan, who's a provocative, independent thinker. He's an economist at George Mason University. He's also the New York Times best-selling author. We had him, I think the last time we had him on a show was to talk about his previous book, one of his previous books, The Case Against Education, Why the Education System is a Waste of Time and Money, arguing against the very system we were just talking about, and that he's a part of. His new book, Don't Be a Feminist, Essays on Genuine Justice. Professor Kaplan joins us now. Brian, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Fantastic to be here.
And so this latest book is positioned as sort of a letter to your daughter to not be a feminist.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yes.
Yeah. So make the case why your daughter and I guess nobody else's daughter should be a quote unquote feminist.
Right. Well, my daughter's 10 years old, and I've been thinking about this for a long time. What do I tell her about this when she comes home from school and says, "Dad, they told me that I should be a feminist"? I mean, and the way that I start the book is, well, what even is a feminist? If you go to some dictionaries, they'll say it's just the view that women should be treated equally with men, economically, politically, socially. And the funny thing is, if you look at public opinion, almost everyone believes that, whether they're a feminist or not. It is not a good definition of feminism. I say what feminism really is about is the view that our society treats men more fairly than women. And what I do in the first chapter is I say, well, let's just go through all the main complaints that people have about the treatment of women. But then let's go through the list of all the main complaints people have about the treatment of men. And then let's really dig into them and see whether they hold water. And what I tell her is, in the end, it really does not look like it's true that our society does, in fact, treat men more fairly than women. So don't be a victim.
And part of this,
don't
too,
like one.
And part of this is, like, you know, the term feminism has gone through some iterations because the second wave feminists of the 60s are different than the third wave feminists of the 90s, different than whatever constitutes a feminist today, which forces you to be an ally with some forces or advocates that previous iterations of feminists would probably disagree with in terms of. You know, that these advocates run counter to feminism. Actually, we had, you know, a self-described radical feminist on the show yesterday who argues against the idea that, for example, a man saying he's a woman is not the same thing as a woman, which, you know, puts some groups of feminists in conflict with one another. So part of it is this is ever-evolving political definition of the term based on who's using it.
Yeah, I mean, of course, there are many different versions of feminism, but it would still be very strange for someone to say, I think our society treats men and women equally fairly. The treatment of women is totally fine. And I'm a really extreme feminist.
Yeah.
That would just still be odd. I mean, so they say, so, you know, like it is possible. No doubt there are a few people like that, but that's not the normal meaning of the word. If someone says that women are treated very fairly in our society compared to men, or someone said, yeah, I think that actually our society treats women more fairly than men. Men are treated unfairly. And I'm a feminist. It almost goes against the meaning of the word. It really is something where it's almost built in, not absolutely, but almost built in. And then the question is, all right, fine, is it true? Right. So, yeah, you were already mentioning the pay gap. How much of the pay gap really does reflect just simple unfairness against women? I mean, this is one where if it really were the case that women were paid 30% less for exactly the same work, there's the big question, well, why don't firms just fire all their men and replace them with women for 30% less money?
Exactly.
That really is a get-rich-quick scheme, and it doesn't require a lot of brain power to implement if the premises are true, which I think really says that it's not. I am an economist. So I go over a lot of the evidence on this and just say, look, it's just not correct. I also go over evidence on, is it really true that women, when you count unpaid labor and paid labor in the household, do more than men? And again, that does not seem to be true either. It is correct that there are some women who do put in more than men, namely single moms. On the other hand, stay-at-home moms do a lot less.
Wow.
So if you look at the dads in dads and families of stay-at-home moms, when you add up their work, where their paid work plus their unpaid work, it's a lot more than the moms in those families. Right. So these are all things where I'm really just trying to get my daughter thinking about it, but also to say, look, I don't want you to give in to what I call antipathy and self-pity. Don't feel bad about a large group of other people in society, especially men, and don't feel sorry for yourself. Instead, think about the opportunities that you have and try to go and craft a life that is appealing to you without having these false ideas that the world is stacked against you, which it just isn't.
Good for you. And now, does that include, if you're a feminist, can you also be a mother? Because a lot of people I know, back in the day, they were feminists and they said, I'm a Democrat, I'm a feminist, and I don't need to have a child to feel complete and whole. And now they're regretting that decision.
Right. Well, so, I mean, obviously plenty of people say they're feminists do have kids. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it is a viewpoint that lends itself to not having kids because, if men are treating us so badly, why do I want to go and tie my life to some guy and then go and have kids with him and then perpetuate this horrible cycle? So, yeah, I mean, while it is not necessarily the case that feminists don't want to have kids, I think it is a worldview that just the antipathy and the self-pity, right? If you feel antipathy for other men, for men, and sorry for yourself, then the idea of having kids seems like, gee, why would I want to go and make my life even worse in alliance with some guy who's going to treat me badly? Obviously, there are bad guys in the world. There's also bad women in the world. What I tell my daughter is, try to go and find the good people. And it's not going to be helpful to go and assume that the world is fundamentally stacked against you. That is not a constructive attitude to have when you're trying to figure out a best way to craft a life for yourself.
Is there any evidence that a patriarchy exists from your review of the evidence? Brian, what about the lack of female CEOs representative of the population in Fortune 1000 companies? Isn't that evidence that women in corporate America are up against a glass ceiling, for example?
Right. Well, if by patriarchy you just mean that there are differences in performance, then it's fine. There's a patriarchy, but that's trivial. For it to really matter, it would have to be that it is based upon unfairness, that a equally qualified woman who works just as hard is not going to be as successful on average in business, in science, in technology. And that's where I say just the evidence is not there. Right. So in general, the best explanation for differences in performance is differences in behavior. To be a CEO basically means that you're giving up almost everything else in your life in order to succeed. It's like being an Olympic athlete. Right. So if you look at the childhood of an Olympic athlete, it's not a fun childhood. Basically, you spend all your time doing volleyball or whatever. Right. And then the question is, well, if you like, is it unfair if someone that doesn't feel like devoting their life to volleyball can't win the Olympics? It's not unfair. In fact, I would say the wise choice is not to devote your life to volleyball.
Don't tell Amy that.
I've annoyed some people in the past just by saying I would not support my child if they wanted to be an Olympian. Say, look, what's so great about winning in some sport people barely care about and being a champion in that? You have to give up your old child for that? That's ridiculous. No, I'm not waking up at 4 a.m. for you to ice skate.
I love it. But, yeah, no.
A lot of people
that's
their life.
Well, you know what it is? That's the patriarchy talking, Brian. You don't even know it. You're part of the patriarchy. You know, it's a subconscious.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of what I say is that much of feminism is just about raising the bar to the point where almost anything counts as an affront and unfairness. And, you know, that's just not a reasonable way to go through life, to say that, well, in order for us to have a fair society, women have to the government has to go and give women money to go and have kids. It's like, so why? Why is it that it's unfair unless complete strangers go and support you? It seems like a very high bar to say the universe is against me unless I get the following conditions met. It's not a reasonable approach.
And so when you see things that are ubiquitous, like, for example, you know, WBE, DBE designations for women-owned business enterprise, disadvantaged business enterprise designations that get priority when it comes to government contracts, or even, you know, contracts in the private sector because they place value in those designations as well. How do you react to that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a clear case of unfairness against men, where you've got two businesses that are equally qualified, where the male one is more qualified, and then you say, well, because the owner is a woman, we're giving it to her anyway. You know, if you were to go and imagine reversing that, people would be very upset, and with good reason. You know, these are basically laws that are designed to cause unfairness in the name of fighting unfairness. Right? And again, all based upon this equivocation of if the society were fair, then outcomes would be equal, which is ridiculous. You can't look at me here, but like, I'm not even 6 feet tall. I could never be a professional basketball player. That doesn't mean that they're unfair to me. It just means that I'm not qualified and I haven't put the time in, but also I just don't have the right stuff for that. You know, if there are differences in abilities between people, we should expect differences in outcomes. Differences in motivation, we should expect different outcomes. Does not mean that anyone was mistreated. And it is pernicious to go and make up false accusations of mistreatment. It leads to negative attitudes towards others and feeling bad about yourself. So why do it?
And to those who suggest, well, you know, 2022 America, okay, fine, I may be, open to your assessment of the evidence, but you're not looking at all of the legacy impacts of women being discriminated against under the law, like I mentioned at the outset, like not even being offered the right, or being you know, given the right to vote equal to men.
Right. I mean, of course, that's about 100 years ago. I mean, if you were to talk about things that would be plausibly more relevant, it would be, say, well, in the 50s, weren't women discriminated against back then? Even there, I would say that it's, you know, there's a big distinction between differences in attitudes and actual unfairness. So in the 1950s, you have a society where women are much more focused on getting married and having kids. And to say, well, that is caused by discrimination, well, maybe those were different attitudes that women had at the time. You know, if men can change their mind about what they want out of life, why can't women change their mind out of what they want out of life? To go and say that a preference isn't legitimate because it's somehow shaped by your society.
Yes.
Well, we're all shaped by our society. So to just say, well, like, that doesn't count. So, like, sorry, you're raised Catholic. All right, well, now, well, it's it is oppression that you are Catholic now. So, well, that's what I am now. Right. So to go and be blaming people for that kind of thing, again, is just raising the bar to an insanely high level. Right. And just realize, look, if you grow up in a society with certain gender norms, you'll probably accept them. That doesn't mean that you were oppressed. You know, the only question really is, what if you grow up in that society and you don't want something else?
Mm-hmm.
Right. What happens then? Right. And, even in times like that, if a woman wanted to go and do a non-traditional major, like, it's not like they're going to say, no, you're not allowed to. Right? You know, yes, people may be surprised. Again, if you do something that is unusual, other people will be surprised. Does it make sense to say that shows the whole world is stacked against me because when I do something unusual, people are surprised? Like, that's life. Why is it that you would interpret that as unfairness against you rather than just the basic way that all human beings are and have always been?
It's in the immortal words of Bobby Brown, it's my prerogative. And it's her prerogative, exactly right.
Yeah, it's good.
Brian Kaplan.
Yeah, I was wondering.
You were wondering how I was going to fit Bobby Brown into our conversation? Oh, there you go.
I was just thinking of Millie Bobby Brown from Stranger Things. I'm like, oh, that's right. This is totally
there's another Bobby Brown. Yeah, exactly. That preceded him. Yes, right. Brian Kaplan, professor of econ at George Mason and New York Times bestselling author. His most recent book, Don't Be a Feminist, Essays on Genuine Justice.
Yes, and you can get it, and you can get this from Amazon for $12 for paperback, or ebook is $9.99. So
very good. All right, very good. Professor Kaplan, thanks as always for joining us. Good luck with the book. Appreciate it.
All right, my pleasure. Talk to you later. Bye.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.